The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I hope you understand my weird accent.
Not yet.
Okay. What I'm going to say is exploratory. So I'm going to get some things wrong, and so we should have a good discussion, I hope. So don't sit there thinking, ha-ha, got him, because I'll be glad to hear that, okay? So let me start by saying that one problem that revolutionary socialists face all the time is that their theories get overtaken by events and by new developments. And theory has to rise again to the level of practice. Over and over again this happens. Now back in 1997, I can now advertise, I edited a book called Revolutionary Rehearsals, which Haymarket reissued. And that book looked at five moments in when the possibility of socialist revolution seemed to be renewed. France in 1968, Chile in 1972-3, Portugal 1974-5, Iran 1978-9, and Poland 1980-81. I should just mention that we're hoping to produce a second edition of this book. Neil, who's sitting over there in the corner, and another comrade and I are getting together a new book, which will be kind of update the whole, well, not update that book, but deal with the last 38 years. But looking back now at this book, it's very clear, as it was not clear then, that the book was conceived and written at the end of a period, or after the end of a period, a particular period in the history of global capitalism. It was conceived and written in a new period, which we were only beginning to grasp. We didn't still have a name for it. We didn't have a clear analysis of it. At the time, we might have called it monetarism, or Reaganism, or Thatcherism. Later on, we might have called it post-Fordism, or globalization. Now perhaps we call it financialized capitalism or neoliberalism. But whatever name we give to the present period, its formation altered the conditions under which revolutions might develop and the new kinds of possibilities that emerged. Now in 1987 we might have supposed, as we did, I think, if you'd asked me in 1987, what do you think the future's going to be like? I would have said, well, obviously more of the same, only better. That everything would repeat itself on hopefully on a grander scale. So what had happened in the events we discussed in these books was that in all of them, workers in large scale industries, in big factories, played a leading role in revolutionary situations. In France, in the factory occupations, in the cordones, in Chile, in the shipyards and the factories of Portugal, the oil fields of Iran, and of course in the shipyards, the factories and the coal mines of Poland. The militant workplace forces in large workplaces were central to all of those events. And so you could expect, as I would have done if you'd asked me in 1987, that the next time that revolt broke out in Eastern Europe, it would be like solidarity only on a bigger scale. Huge strike, factory occupations, workers asserting their own demands and so on. But it didn't turn out that way. And I want to begin with how it didn't turn out that way, and then go on in the last part to talk about the last 20 years. But in 1989 to 1990, there were several very important developments. The first, which I'm not going to talk about, was in China, where a student-led mass movement demanding democracy was brutally crushed by the regime. Secondly, in Eastern Europe, Russia's former satellites succumbed one after another to movements that brought them into the orbit of liberal democracy. And then in 1990, Nelson Mandela, after 27 years in jail, was released and 4 years later became the president of South Africa. Now, there were revolutions, but they weren't following patterns that we had expected, or we might have expected. After it was brutally crushed in the military coup in Poland at the end of 1981, Solidarity went underground. It had a big underground, and it rebuilt itself in the underground, but it rebuilt itself on a new basis. The leadership shifted their understandings and they shifted their ambitions. They had been advocates of workers' control of industry. Now, they were advocates of freedom, but what they meant by freedom was freedom of the market. And they increasingly came to believe that that's what freedom meant. They looked to the West for their models. In a horrible moment in 1988, Margaret Thatcher visited Poland, and she was cheered in the streets of Gdansk, the center of workers' revolt, by massive crowds who identified her as a friend. Can you imagine Trump being cheered? Okay, if that's thought it would, that's the kind of feeling it would have. But they weren't alone in being converted to the idea that the market was the way forward. The rulers of Poland were also converted to the idea that the communist rulers of Poland, encouraged by Gorbachev, also because state capitalism was running more and more into crisis, looked to the market as the way forward. And in 1988, the end of 1988, the government finally decided to sit down with the representatives of Solidarity at a round table and negotiated that there would be the first free elections in Poland. And when they happened, Solidarity swept the board, formed a new government, and introduced neoliberal policies. Former revolutionary socialist Gordjaczek Kuron became the Minister of Labour and would go on television doing fireside chats explaining what a good thing unemployment was. In Hungary, there were similar processes. One commentator referred to the transformation in Hungary as what he called a revolution, a revolution with an F. In other words, half revolution, half reform. And in both cases, the degree of popular involvement in the change was really quite small. Lech Wałęsa, former leader of Solidarity, said that this was a very good thing. The problems of the street, he said, must be solved for the sake of the street, but not by the street. Okay? Not by the street. Elsewhere in Eastern Europe, in 1989, other regimes resisted the tide for a period, only they didn't have the backing of the Russians anymore. In East Germany, in the autumn, mass demonstrations finally brought down the Berlin Wall, or opened up the Berlin Wall, and opened the way to the reunification of Germany. In Czechoslovakia, similar processes. In neither case did those revolutions involve a single death. There were large numbers of deaths in Romania right at the end of the year, when finally things were put to an end, when Ceausescu and his wife were executed by a firing squad on Christmas Day. But what you have, whatever there was, whether there was popular involvement, whether there was violence or not, the thing that was distinctive for socialists about what happened in Eastern Europe in 1989, I think, was that there was very little in the way of independent working class organization. Independent working class assertion of demands. We come to South Africa. It might seem odd to see the look at the end of apartheid in South Africa and the end of communism in Eastern Europe in the same terms, but there are similarities. They finally released Nelson Mandela after 27 years in jail and opened the way to talks with the ANC. But the regime was very resistant to giving anything away. It took 4 years involving a great deal of state-organized violence against the people before finally, in 1994, free elections were agreed, and of course, Nelson Mandela and the ANC won an overwhelming victory and set South Africa on the road to, anyway, parliamentary democracy. Within 2 years, they'd introduced neoliberal policies in South Africa. No significant progress was made in lessening the enormous racial inequalities in South Africa. The situation of the working class was not massively improved, apart from the political freedoms that workers gained, which we never sniff at. South Africa became what some people have called the protest capital of the world, but the problems of ordinary South Africans continue to this day. Now, looking back, the East European and South African events fitted into a pattern, it seems to me, which first emerged in the mid-1970s with the end of fascism in Spain. It was a series of what were called, well, some political scientists have called, negotiated transitions to democracy. They ran through from Spain, through Latin America, Argentina, Brazil, the Philippines, South Korea. The installation of forms of parliamentary democracy in place of formerly military or authoritarian regimes. And the effect on the world as a whole was actually quite significant. There was one study that was published by the Open University in Britain, which gave a simple, stark set of figures. In 1975, they said, 69% nearly of the world's national governments were reckoned to be authoritarian. 69% in 1975. In 1995, they said 26.2% were reckoned to be authoritarian. So that period is a period of the expansion across the globe, not the whole of the globe, but of many parts of the globe, of the elementary forms of parliamentary democracy. Two regions were unaffected by this, of course, the Middle East and China. And there were similarities amongst these cases. What happened in it, I'm generalizing furiously, but what happened was that the ruling classes saw the writing on the wall in the authoritarian states and opted to negotiate an end to openly authoritarian regimes on definite political conditions. The conditions politically were that each side in the negotiations would keep out the hardliners on their own side. So the negotiators for the regime would keep out their hardliners, the torturers and the murderers, and the extremists, as it were, of their side. And on the other side, the opposition, would keep out the radicals. And would keep out the anti-capitalists and any voices of that sort. Because the other part of the deal was that what would be introduced would be unambiguously capitalism. Capitalism would continue only now with a parliamentary form. The positions of landlords and capitalists and so on would not be threatened. And there was also usually built into the deal that there would not be much in the way of punishment or justice for the old torturers and murderers. The military would go back to their barracks unmolested. And there might be a few sacrificial lambs. A few dictators had to be flown out in the helicopters of reaction usually supplied by your government. and in Romania, well, we had a couple of executions, Ceausescu and his wife being shot on Christmas Day. Rather pleasant Christmas, that. What the negotiated transitions involved was revolutions without the threat of popular insurgency, keeping that to a risk, that down. And they involved various kinds of particular machineries. They were usually called pacts. So it was the Pact of Moncloa in Spain, for example. There were round tables where the opposition and the regime would sit down together to work things out together. There were amnesties for former crimes. And in South Africa, they set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and so on. Politically, they required a reforming wing in the ruling class, and within the opposition, it required a dominant reformist wing, which would be prepared to contain popular demands. Remember Lech Wałęsa's expression, not by the street. So far as policy was concerned, all sides were to agree that economic liberalisation was relatively uncontentious. Now, those conditions, in combination, did not outlast the mid-1990s. And I'll come to the period since the mid-1990s, which we're in a minute. But first of all, I want to say, what does this mean? Ask a question. What exactly does all this mean for theories of revolution? What's the count as a revolution? And what kinds of revolution are there? Because it seems that the scope of revolutions has somewhat expanded beyond what the classics of Marxism might have recognized. Now, one useful approach comes from the historian Charles Tilly, who was quite honest that he borrowed a lot from a couple of people called Lenin and Trotsky. And he stressed two things in his theorization. The first was that revolutions are really, or revolutionary situations are really very common. They're not unusual, they happen a lot. And secondly, a revolution is a phenomenon, a political phenomenon, with two characteristics. The first one is that it always involves what he calls a revolutionary situation. And the second is that it always has an outcome. Well, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? Now, what's a revolutionary situation? We've got some classic definitions from Marxism, but I'm going to work with Tilly's, because he's got a more general, he's got a broader conception of revolutions than some we've inherited, in a sense, from the classics of Marxism. The first thing that marks a revolutionary situation is that some group claims state power from those who've already got it, which is not in itself very exciting. I mean, I claim state power it doesn't really, by itself, that doesn't amount to much. The second condition is really important, which is that the claim of the group that is claiming state power gets significant support from an important sectors of the population. It doesn't define what they are, but it says there has to be significant support. And the third part of the definition is that the forces of the old order, particularly the army and the police, either can't or don't want to repress the supporters of the claim. In which case, it's a straightforward political crisis in society. Existing power relations are upset. The challengers are demanding a new way of ruling, a new way of being ruled, and are trying to make that stick. Note that this allows that both popular movements may be challenging, but it also includes things like attempted military coups, civil wars, and attempted counter-revolutions. They all fall in that definition. It includes successful as well as defeated challenges. Now so the range of variations, big. It can include events, revolutionary situations, which involve large masses of people, laying siege to the state, like, say, think of Egypt in end of January, beginning of February 2011. There's massive crowds in Suez and Cairo and so on, and Alexandria, demanding the end to Mubarak's rule and so on. But it may not, as in Poland or Hungary. No big crowds. It can include massive outpourings of what Tilly calls new thought. But it may not. There were no new ideas really kicking around in Eastern Europe in the revolutions of 1989. So not every revolution involves massive new thought. Sometimes, some revolutions, the people challenging may challenge only for state power. In others, they may be challenging the power of the businessmen, the landlords, the bankers, whoever. But they may not. It depends what we're talking about. So what I want to stress is the range of variation. Trotsky wrote that in his wonderful book, The History of the Russian Revolution, that revolutions involve the intervention of the masses into political life. Well, when you look at the full range of revolutions that have happened, that's not always true. Not always true. In some cases, one sort of revolution may spill over and transform itself into another. So in classic case of this, 1974 in Portugal, the revolution begins with a military coup. Junior officers in the army overthrow the old fascist regime. What do they do when they've done this? They immediately issue a call to the people to support them, and it becomes a popular revolution. In a way that I don't remember any occasion in the past quite like that. It was very exciting. The same happened in a, well, anyway, I don't want to spend too long on the example. I'm going to run out of my time. So it's apparent that this, if the pattern of events that happens during revolutionary situations is variable, it's also the case that the outcomes are variable, of course. Sometimes the challengers gain power, successful revolution. Sometimes they come to a compromise with the old regime, and sometimes they get defeated. Revolutions can be defeated, perhaps because the old regime has remobilized its forces, like in 1905 in Russia, or in 1956 in Hungary, the Russians invaded Hungary to defeat the People's Revolution in Hungary. Okay, so we've got a wide range of variation. Can we classify the types? I want to draw two distinctions. And I am grateful to my comrade Neil Davidson, whose ideas I'm now going to misrepresent. The first distinction is between political revolutions and social revolutions. Now, I'll explain the distinctions in a minute. The second is between bourgeois revolutions and potentially socialist revolutions. Now, a political revolution only changes the character of the state. For example, it removes a hasty dictator, it installs parliamentary democracy, or in the opposite case, it smashes up parliamentary democracy by military or fascist takeover. On the other hand, a social revolution goes further. Doesn't just alter the state, it alters the whole pattern of social reproduction in society, of societal reproduction, or what Marxists call the mode of production. Now, something needs to be added to that, which is that distinction is sometimes fought out during an actual revolutionary situation. Because there are sometimes situations in which what some people are fighting for a political revolution, but others want a social revolution. And you can have a situation where some forces want to do more than change the state, They want a wholescale reconstruction of society, property, everything, and they lose out in the end. And basically, part of the history of the socialist movement is of that, of those forces. So we claim as our, we stand in the line of inheritance of the levellers and the diggers in the English Revolution, of the sans-culottes and the enragés of the French Revolution, the Spartacists in the German Revolution of 1918-19, and the Poom in the Spanish Civil War. The losers, but they're our losers. And they were fighting for different kinds of revolutions. Of course, we have to remember that not all revolutions involve those challenges from below or from the left. Some political revolutions involve large-scale involvement of the people, some don't. And you can say the same about the social revolutions. In order to understand that, I think we need a second definition or distinction between bourgeois revolutions and potentially socialist revolutions. And this is a distinction. Let's see what bourgeois revolution is first. Now, a very broad definition. A bourgeois revolution is a revolution whose outcome is that it destroys the fetters that prevented the development of a new autonomous capitalism, I think broadly. A new centre of capital accumulation. And historically, bourgeois revolutions have been very variable in form. Especially, some of them involved large-scale involvement of ordinary people, and some didn't. Some didn't. The transformation of excuse me. Thanks. One moment. I'm sorry. The transformation of social reproduction patterns away from the predominance of feudal or absolutist or tributary patterns towards capitalism becoming dominant didn't logically require any popular involvement at all. Not logically. Bourgeois revolutions could be accomplished from above. There's a classic case in the 19th century, the Meiji Restoration, as it's called in Japan, when Japan moved from being a tributary society to a capitalist society. There was hardly any popular involvement at all. It was carried out above, from above. One army defeated another, new set of guys came in and instituted capitalism, quite deliberately. Borrowed from abroad, saw that that was the only way forward, unless they were going to get colonized, and built a Japanese capitalism. So class upheavals from below were either absent from or very carefully contained in many of the revolutions which set a whole array of different countries on the path towards capitalism. That's really what Gramsci was talking about when he talked about passive revolution in Italy in the 19th century. So, coming back to where we were, what we had from the mid-1970s to the mid-1990s was a predominant pattern in which there were political revolutions which registered changes in capitalism and helped changes in capitalism in some ways. They were part of the change in capitalism from the previous form to neoliberalism. But apart from Iran and Poland in that period, there were no big challenges from below that raised the possibility of socialist revolution. And then things changed. And this is the best bit of the story, which is bringing us up to where we are now. Because I think we're in a period which is more encouraging than the period of from the mid-1970s to the mid-1990s. And the big change that's happened in terms of what's happening with popular insurgency is that political economy questions about capitalism are posing themselves now in everyday popular insurgency across the world. And that's the key thing to understanding revolutionary rehearsals in the 21st century. because the previous pattern of insurgency was trying to get rid of authoritarian regimes, trying to install parliamentary democracies. Now, the interconnections between governments and states on the one side and capitalism are coming more and more to the fore. And I think there's a moment which is symbolically significant, and it's the 1st of January 1994. They suddenly, from the jungles of Chiapas in southern Mexico, the Zapatistas emerge and issue their first manifesto. And in that manifesto, they tie together opposition to the state and opposition to the North American Free Trade Agreement. They tie together opposition to the indigenous oppression and capitalism. And it's a symbolic turning point. Movements perhaps before, there'd been lots and lots of food riots in the previous 15 years across the global south, but they hadn't generalized in that way. And what the Zapatistas were brilliant at was publicity. And they put that question on the world map. For the whole of the left across the world sat up and took notice, if they were the sort of left that could sit up and take notice, because that isn't always the case. Now, neoliberalism was now deeply embedded in the world economy by the time we get to the mid-90s. There's all sorts of ways of characterising it. One is to note that there's now an immense mass of unregulated private capital, not controlled by states, sloshing about in the world economy, imposing its will on states, demanding such things as lower taxes, lower corporate taxes on national governments, state governments in the United States. You think about the teachers' strikes and what they were about. Grabbing land for development, as they called it, which meant the development of oil and gas and monocrop cultivation and so on and so on, and luxury developments and golf courses in Scotland, which we all know about, and so on. Privatizing every kind of resource they could, enforcing debt repayment as the first duty of every government, subjugating everything and everyone to a single demand: profit, the rights of money, the right to profit. Wage levels, meanwhile, for millions and millions of workers across the world stagnated or fell. Social spending was cut. Prices for everyday necessities soared. The cost of living in capitalism, both in the global south and in the global north, became higher and higher for food, for fuel, and especially, we have to note, for housing, transport, and so on. And it wasn't simply that the debts of states rose, so also did personal debt, so that whereas the previous generation in the global north could expect all sorts of things from its state without having to pay for them, now that was no longer true. I have a friend who's in London whose daughter for many years believed there was not a division between the 1% and the 99%, but between the old generation and hers. "You could afford a house," she said. "I never will be able to her mother. You know, that the real division in society is between you rotten old people, me, and us that are young and suffering." She's changed her mind now, but never mind. She got radicalized. And the whole system was policed, of course, by the IMF, the WTO, and the World Bank, and all those other bastard institutions. But the mid-1990s saw the emergence globally, unevenly, and so on, sometimes in the hands of church organizations, sometimes in the hands of anarchist organizations, sometimes in the hands of leftist groupings and so on, of movements of resistance to this new order. And they culminated, of course, right at the end of 1999, the very symbolic end of the 20th century, with the demonstrations at Seattle, and then the 2 years of demonstrations against the World Trade Organization that followed. And in, I think, the center of the next few years, the center of struggle is to be seen in Latin America. I'm not an expert on Latin America. I don't read Spanish or Portuguese, and I've had to borrow from some wonderful writers that have written about it, and I'm still wanting to know more. So my remarks maybe get things wrong, get the emphases wrong, and so on. But the year 2000, in the city of Cochabamba, in Bolivia, there's a very important struggle in which quite a few people were killed, in which people fought against what? The privatization of their water supply. And eventually they won a very big, very important battle in Cochabamba against their water supply being privatized. People of Flint remember Cochabamba. It's followed the next year by, at the end of the year, in Argentina, by the Argentinazo. Huge popular movement. What's the issue? Not authoritarian government, but a democratically elected government that is in cahoots with the banks, etc., etc., and is trying to enforce a structural adjustment policy, as it's called now, on the Argentinian people. They drove out, the people of Argentina drove out three presidents, one after another, in a period of some months, in swift succession. In 2002, in Venezuela, in 1998, Hugo Chavez had been elected as the president of Venezuela. 2002, the business elites wanted to get rid of him, saw him as a threat, arrested him, and the people poured out of the barrios of the capital city of Venezuela, whose name I've forgotten. Of Caracas, of course, thank you very much. I knew I'd get it wrong. And defeated the military coup, this business coup against Chavez. The next year in Bolivia, coming back to Bolivia, the first of two, what were called the gas wars, which drove out the president, a violent and corrupt president of Brazil. His successor they threw out 2 years later in 2005 and installed, to popular acclaim, Bolivia's first indigenous president. The majority of the people of Bolivia, of course, are indigenous peoples. This is the first time Evo Morales became the popular president of Bolivia. And then the following year, something I've only learned about recently, and which is, I think, not sufficiently known about on the left in the world, in Oaxaca, as I hope I pronounce it correctly, in Mexico, for several months, there's a popular uprising which installs a rerun of the Paris Commune, drives out the army and the police, sets up popular committees all around a teacher's struggle. Please note teachers. teacher's struggle. And eventually, of course, is defeated as the Paris Commune was. There's two things to note about these Latin American struggles, I think. The first is that they involved very considerable remakings, reconstructions of the popular forces against the regime. Bolivia's a classic example. In the middle to the end of the 1980s, the tin miners of Bolivia, who'd been the center of the labor movement, were absolutely, utterly crushed and defeated. I mean, the miners' defeat in Britain in 1985 was bad enough. The defeat of the tin miners was much worse in terms of its effects. Disoriented, disorganized the working class popular forces. But then new ones were constructed. We saw it happen in Cochabamba. New forces were constructed, not so much on old style worker organizations, but new alliances of workers with indigenous, urban and rural forces, with teachers and other public sector workers, many of them women, often playing central roles, not just fighting for pay and so on, but fighting for better public services. The teachers play a central role in the struggle in Oaxaca as well. Their demands are not just about their pay, they're about school supplies, about school buildings, about their students, and therefore also about their parents. They become the centres of popular organisation. You get alliances between employed and unemployed workers, now emerging in new ways. Landless rural workers in Brazil, in the MST, playing a central role. So there's an active process of recomposition going on of popular movements, which we should not underestimate and which we should constantly be paying attention to in our period. Extensive developments of new kinds of democratic forums and so on. So all sorts of creative and inventive developments going on, new forms of action, new forms of coordination. And sometimes some of the best writing about this has come from anarchists. We should take note of that as well. But also some, the best of the revolutionary Marxists who've written about this. It's not so much that people have developed new demands, that they have, but also there was a process in the first half of the first decade of the 21st century of new forms of direct popular empowerment. New ways of people trying out new ways of self-governing in agriculture, in urban life, in community life, in workplaces, and so on. Trying out worker-run cooperatives in Argentina, and so on and so on. Now, it's true that the revolutionaries or the radicals, in all cases, were not able to assemble sufficient political forces to pose direct alternative to the existing system. They posed the question of alternatives, but they didn't succeed in assembling enough people to put those at the centre of the political map. They came close. In Buenos Aires, in 2002, there was an opinion poll which said that 40% of the population believed that popular assemblies offered the model for the future of government in Argentina, which is pretty good. You know, we'd be quite pleased if that was the case in Chicago. The second thing to note about these movements is that, of course, they provided the popular energies behind the Pink Tide governments, which for a period attracted the hopes and aspirations of lots of people across the continent and indeed across the world. And what happened was that buoyed for a time on a tide of rising commodity prices, which itself was fueled by rising Chinese demand for raw materials, governments in states like Brazil, Bolivia, Venezuela, some degree Ecuador and so on, were able to bring in social welfare measures and reduce levels of absolute poverty in their countries. They didn't reduce inequality, and they didn't shift the dependence of their countries on what's been called extractivism, basically the reliance on exporting raw materials. But it did protect them for a time from the impact of the 2008 world crisis. But during this decade, of course, commodity prices have not been rising so fast, and eventually they lost their advantage. And their popular support waned, and the right went on the offensive, so that rather than being, as some people saw them, the precursors of 21st century socialism, they involved what the Canadian writer Jeff Weber, in a brilliant book, or a series of brilliant books and articles, has called reconstituted neoliberalism. And what they also succeeded in doing was disarming, to some extent, the radical impulses of the first half of the decade, throwing the left forces back into rethinking and reassembling. As one of the writers in the book that we hope to bring out with Haymarket next year put it, the radicals began to seem a little naive. There was a crisis in the relationships between the movements and the left governments, which the movements did not succeed in overcoming. Vice President Linera claims to be a Marxist. The Vice President of Bolivia declares that the Morales government is, quote, the government of the social movements. But it's the government, okay, which decides which movements are to count and which are to be contained and maligned in the press and so on. Now, I'm finishing, fortunately, I'm sorry. A couple more minutes and I'm done. The financial crisis of 2008 took time for it to turn its effects into popular insurgency, in a sense. The Social Democratic Party certainly offered no alternative to the crisis. In Britain, they were responsible for introducing the government, the official response to it. But unions helped to contain popular resistance. But the crisis was felt in the Social Democratic parties. Labour lost the election in 2010. Most severely, the crisis was felt in Greece. The PASOK party which was the leading Social Democratic party, lost just about all its votes. In Iceland, a kind of centrist government was actually kicked out by the people with calls to jail the bankers, and a few of them were jailed, which was great. But not many other parts of the world saw bankers arrested. There came then a big impulse, of course, on the Arab Spring in 2011. I'm not going to say much about the Arab Spring, but just to note that sadly, outside Tunisia, of course, it was beaten back at terrible cost, most obviously in Syria. In Egypt, where big worker strikes that played a major part in the fall of Mubarak, the whole movement was defeated in 2013, in part because the secular left made a terrible mistake in believing that the Muslim Brotherhood were to be equated with a threat from the army in the name of secularism, the same impulse that produces Islamophobia amongst some of the left in parts of Europe today. But so all the kinds of beginnings of popular impulses that we saw in the Egyptian Revolution, which have been documented in numbers of books and articles, people wanting not simply to get rid of Mubarak, but also the many little Mubaraks in local government, in business, and so on and so on, all of that's gone. But 2011 was also the year, partly inspired by the Egyptian events, of the Indignados in Spain and Portugal and Greece, with political anger at the corruption and the tying in with capital of governments, the demand for real democracy now, which was sounded on the squares of Spain, was extremely popular. And then came Occupy, of course, in your country, in the autumn of that year, which sowed seeds which are still sprouting today, as far as I can tell, across. They were defeated. They didn't win the Occupy, but they haven't gone away. My impression is that they sowed a set of seeds which proved to be very fertile. We saw similar movements in Quebec, where they did actually bring down the government, in Chile, in Turkey, Brazil over transport prices. So what's been happening is the remaking of a popular left. It's not organized. There is a popular left out there in country after country, people who are not dissatisfied with the way things are, looking for alternatives, and so on. It's produced new parties, which have been disappointed, but the classic one being Syriza in Greece, elected by the popular movement and then promptly collapsed in the face of the Troika, created for Demos, whose leaders are determined to contain the popular impulses in the framework of conventional politics. You still see the same impulses at work. I mean, you in America noted, couldn't avoid taking note last weekend, of the huge demonstrations against ICE across America, but 2 days before in Madrid. You might not have noticed this one. Big demonstration in Madrid. What was its slogan? Down with the violence of the bankers. Fantastic. Down with the violence of the mortgage companies and the providers of social housing. Noting the, what's important about it is linking the banks to violence. Violence against ordinary people and their need for housing. So finally, just, and this is really the last words I want to say, in a period when obviously the right is partly resurgent in country after country across yours and our parts of the world. It's also the case that the crisis is pushing all manner of layers of people towards the possibilities of revolt, involving processes of regroupment, rebuilding of organisation, reimagining the future. And the key issue, I think, is whether, as this, the writer Kim Moody has said, we are able to consolidate and build a militant minority that's clear about one question, that working class democratic control is the key issue in left politics. Democratic control of our own organisations, our own movements, our own campaigns, and democratic control of our societies. There are going to be many new fronts of struggle, new social forces emerging, new battles. The 21st century is going to be full of dangers, but I hope it's also full of promise. Thanks a lot.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.